You for sticking it out. So I'm just gonna hopefully give you a few things to remember this conference by, and then send those of you off who are leaving, and I guess the rest of you, so I'll see you next week. So just a quick wrap up. This was our conference. As you've already heard, these are triangular conferences that rotate between Solvay, APSA in Paris, and I guess this particular one was partially funded by European Research Council, but basically the conferences are supposed to rotate every year. Every 3 years, it'll be back here. But the reviews are in, the conference is eclectic, not your grandfather's cosmology conference, a welcome break from Brexit, so very interesting conference. If you've been impressed, you like what you've seen, there will be the next one in Paris, a little bit more sights to see over there, not maybe comparable to Waterloo, maybe a little bit more, so if you get bored with the talks, there are other things to do as well. So that would be less than a year from now, so you can put this on your calendar. I don't know if they can register for it now, can they? Not yet, but soon. So that should be fun. And just in case you are wondering, and there were questions, everything has been recorded. This is being recorded now. Everything you see in Parameter is on file somewhere. So, but the good thing is that if you're ashamed of what you've said, you could go tell us, and we're going to erase it. So you can go and watch your talks here. I think the Adam Riess's colloquium is not listed here. It has a separate link, but everything is there. And in general, if there's anything, any talk that has ever been given at Parameter, well, the ones that have been recorded, you can find it here on this website, PureSA. You can just Google it. So you can find everything over there, videos, the slides, in various formats. This was a very productive meeting. Three of our speakers and won awards shortly after they gave their talks. So clearly there have been, I guess, the award committee, whoever they were watching, who were inviting, and then decided to pick their winners from a list of invitees. In particular, this was actually, these people won the awards for breakthroughs in fundamental physics, and of course, this conference are frontiers of cosmological frontiers of fundamental physics. So it was very exactly the same topic. So that's good. So hopefully more people from our speakers will win awards soon. So I promise to end very quickly as much as I can. Although of course, hopefully there might be some discussions and questions. I'm going to show some questions, but. Some of the buzzwords that came out through the talks, there were new observations, there were new tensions, there were new tools, new ideas. And of course, physics, as we all know it, physics and astrophysics are interplay of all these. None of them actually work in vacuum, but they're all interconnected to each other. And we discuss all of them in one way or another in this meeting. So I'm just going to show you some things that stuck out in my mind and might be very quick or depending on how much questions you ask. So this was at least one version of the plot that Giorgio Statiu showed in his talk. This is kind of the masterpiece of observational cosmology is how well our model, which is the curve here, goes through the data points of various types. However, everything is not fine and dandy, though there are some tensions, even if you look at Planck, and this came out, although Giorgio Statiu was downplaying it, this is from a recent paper that Adam Riess highlighted. If you just look at the high L and low L Planck data, you could see that it looks like there's a tension between the parameters, in particular the supernovae Hubble constant seemed to be consistent with low L Planck data, but the high L Planck data is very much inconsistent. So that sounds kind of weird. Of course, he's saying it's maybe 2.5 sigma, it's not very important, but it kind of looks weird. So it's really up to you. And of course, you really want to have more precise measurements, maybe at higher L's or independent measurements to see whether this tension would go away or get the smaller. I guess if Statio was arguing that tension gets smaller. But I don't know if anybody has any comment on this. Was anybody convinced that there was, by George's talk, that there was no tension in Planck data? Or
what's the right axis here?
So this is Hubble. This is some just measure of sound horizon.
But this right axis.
The color is omega matter or matter density. Yeah. Right. It's this little omega matter. It has H squared factor in it, but it's basically matter density today. Right. So I think he was arguing that if you add more data, then these two become a little bit more consistent, but I don't think there is very, very much more data in Planck. So I don't really know whether if Statio's talk, and I'm gonna, he's not here to actually defend himself, but I'm not quite sure whether that really changes the situation very much. So this is a 2.5 sigma tension.
I think he was disputing that even with the standard official data, as far as I understand.
Yeah.
So it was not.
This is official data. This is a standard official data.
Yeah. But even with the official data, you didn't have such a big discrepancy between low L and high L. So I don't know where.
Yeah.
How did they?
So I don't. I mean, I think maybe part of it is exactly whether you add polarization to high L and low L or not. So this is, I think, just TT and low. I think lower polarization. So that's also another thing that's kind of weird, that depending on whether you add polarization or not, tensions become bigger or smaller. So that's, but again, it could be that, so the point I've heard from Douglas Scott is that you have dozens of these plots in Planck papers, and you could focus on the one that shows the tension, and it could be just a Lukalsfer effect, if you will, that of course there would be one plot that has some tension in it. So, but of course, the much bigger tension is the one that, of course, Adam Riess is, I think, betting his second Nobel Prize on. Or I guess he wants to base his second Nobel Prize on, depending on your point of view. So he has various ways, I think dozens of ways of presenting it. This is the way you would look at it in a French restaurant, maybe, I'm not sure. So you have a price fixed menu, and you could get to pick your data sets and then combine them. And his argument was that the early universe is always lower than the late universe. And he has this discrepancy or tension matrices. It was the first time I had seen it. So he's clearly spent a lot of time on this. And he's arguing that depending on various combinations of late universe and early universe, you always have something between 3 to 6 sigma tension. So the question is it new physics or is it the catastrophic multiple failures? I guess these are the two buzzwords that we heard. I really like the second one, catastrophic multiple failures. On the one hand, there is weight of history for the catastrophic multiple failures, the history of Hubble tension, or Hubble tension is a very old, as an old and illustrious history, going to the founders of cosmology, Alan Sandage and who else?
De
Vaucouleurs, right? Yes, good. So that's the weight of history. But then maybe things are much better now. Technology has made progress. Maybe as observers have learned the lessons from the past. And I guess that's Adam's kind of selling point, that he's saying that we have all these multiple ways of doing things and they all give you the same tension. So maybe it might be time to consider this new physics. Certainly theorists don't have, I guess Bob was saying that theorists don't have anything better to do. So why not consider possible new physics? So it could be dynamical or fluctuating or interacting dark energy. There are all papers that discuss that. So this is from Hubble's Hunter's Guide that, again, Adam Riess had highlighted. So if there is some dynamical dark energy, about a redshift of a few thousand, maybe that's the way to do it. It doesn't seem particularly compelling and seems very contrived. But if that's what the data needs, then that's what the data needs. So eventually you have to give in after so many sigmas. This is something that we attempted at some point a few years ago. What if dark energy is not a deterministic model, but the same way that CMB is stochastic, dark energy history is also stochastic. And indeed, there are models that fit the data just as well as lambda CDM do, but then could also solve the Hubble tension. So here the idea is that all these models, as long as at redshift 1,000, they have like a few percent dark energy or over 10% dark energy. And redshift 0, the dark energy is 70%, they work. And so that's another point of view, but that requires, so all of these requires kind of a change in, well, simplest lambda CDM model. Anybody, so I guess Adam was very much obsessed by taking a poll. He then checked with me exactly how many people. He had counted the people in the room at the time, 48 people. And I think there were 20 something people who say, basically apparently more than 50% of the people in the room at the time believe that this is new physics. So is it fair? I mean, it's a different room and Adam is not here, so maybe you can speak more freely. who thinks it's new physics? Just raise your hand. Okay, so I mean, I think it's around 50, if not, yeah, more than 50. Who thinks it's systematics and it's gonna go away? So Latham, Neil, all the PI people.
You should be voting both ways.
Yeah. who voted both ways? Yup, or? No, you said it's kind of, okay. So I guess I want to say parameter people, they're all the more conservative. so
could I ask a question?
Yes.
It's not my area. But I would have thought that in the field, sort of the goal of the field was to compare these numbers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to sort of be able to derive interpretations of it doesn't seem like, you know, that's the way the field evolved. It's sort of a shock, you know, that it doesn't come out that way. And I guess there's enough diversity in the experimental methods that they don't really, they see each other as like outside fields in terms of maybe know enough to know what they're leading uncertainties would be, but not know enough to actually reproduce.
But you know, nobody really knows what's uncertainty of any experiment. I mean, everybody, I mean, so the historically, a lot, all the experimenters underestimate their errors, right? So that means that either, well, I mean, the optimistic point of view is that they don't understand their experiment. And of course, people outside would know even less. So I think it's a question of weight of history. And I guess I think the other bit is there a compelling theory? And I mean, the historical examples, again, are like the opera, I think it came, somebody mentioned that, the superluminal neutrino. That, of course, there were lots of theories, but most people didn't believe it because none of them were very compelling. The other historical example was BICEP, where there was a compelling theory. So everybody believed it, and there were press releases and rumors of Nobel Prizes. But of course, that turned out to be wrong as well. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it just, there are lots of examples that people, experimenters, they don't understand the errors. And yeah, so I think it's fair for people to be skeptical. And I mean, the sigmas don't really mean much at that level. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's different for me. You know, in my field, we have many experiments that are really collecting their own data, but it's the same data. So when they have disagreements, it has to, the real, you know, sort of apples to apples comparisons. When you're looking at two different completely epochs of the universe, you would think that there would be more sort of at least a group who were trying to understand which are discrepancies and which could point to a theory, but maybe it's the absence of good.
Yeah, I think it's absence of a compelling, and it's not that for lack of trying. There are lots of, and I guess this is kind of the state of the art that it, apparently, if you have some early dark energy here, that could do it. Maybe we'll get used to that and believe that. I mean, the dark energy, people didn't believe it early on. I think if the data stays this way, then that might happen. But I think that would require lambda. It was invented by Einstein, so it just took us a while to measure it. This thing hasn't been ordered by anyone, so if it's there, if data really needs it, it require kind of real, I guess, extraordinary evidence, basically, right, for us to believe it. And I think that's a sociological statement. I'm not saying that's necessarily the right.
No, yeah, I mean, you will need some other independent prediction. I mean,
yeah.
In some other
measure. Yeah, right.
Other observation. Okay, you stick something there, fixes maybe H0, but...
That's right, exactly. You need to make a prediction and say that, for example, if you look at the neutrino background, for example, that might you see something differently. Or some other thing that you can predict, and then you can go and measure it, maybe high, just higher resolution CMB. Or I don't know, there could be other predictions. I'm not quite sure. And I think that would be much more, then people probably would believe it, with some exceptions. I mean, not everybody believes dark matter either. Okay, good. Oh, by the way, so this is a bet I have with David Spergel from a few years ago. So this is a double bet. He bets that S-naught discrepancy is due to new physics, not systematics. He believes that the firewalls are not real. So whoever concedes, I guess, has to give the other person dinner either in New York or Toronto, and not Princeton or Waterloo. So I guess he doesn't like either of those places.
Which direction is he betting? Sorry.
Yeah, that is not clear, but he's actually... This is good. If you're a good politician, you have to be very vague. No, but
you two guys go to a restaurant or what?
Well, I mean, it requires somebody conceding, right? So someone needs to get hungry or something. He was saying, and I guess this is a long thread. I had to copy the rest of it.
Well,
but
token in positives, right? So he doesn't believe in the reality of firewalls, right?
Yeah, he doesn't believe in reality of firewalls.
He doesn't believe the discrepancy is due to physics.
He believes that. He's saying that the most H0 discrepancy is due to new physics, but firewalls are not real. So that's what he believes, and I guess I believe the opposite of this too. So whichever, it's a complex bet, and I guess for the purposes of this discussion, doesn't really matter very much. That's how I actually transfer takes you from one day of the conference to that other, from Wednesday to Thursday. So in fact, we did hear about firewalls from all these gentlemen yesterday, except that they all say that they didn't believe in firewalls, although they all had very different reasons for them. So the real question, and I guess if you haven't really followed this firewall controversy, all it really boils down to what happens to information when things fall into the horizon of the black hole. And I mean, Hawking said that it should get out somehow. And there is a long debate as to whether that implies that the standard picture of black holes, as we see in textbooks, is correct or not. So Avery showed this beautiful picture that just won $3 million, saying that no, horizon is there, you see it's all black, and he has other evidence that there isn't any surface there. But then others had different arguments. So James, you could summarize your point of view. So I mean, of course, James thinks that information can get out, but my gathering that it requires some sort of non-locality to get out, not firewalls. Or maybe you could summarize your point of view on this.
Firewalls?
Yeah. I mean, how would information get out of the black hole when it evaporates?
So I would say it stays in the black hole and eventually comes out through the white hole, right?
Through the white hole. Okay, so there's an explosion. Everything stays there. And then does that happen like halfway through or when the black hole is very, very small, when the explosion?
So the black hole evaporates down to the Planck scale.
Down to the Planck scale.
And then the white hole exists for a comparable length of time. And hopefully, I think, somehow uniformly over that time, you get back at all this.
So you're going to violate the holographic entropy bound, right? Because you're saying the whole thing collapses to a Planck size, but still has all the information in it?
So I don't believe the entropy bound applies to what's inside the black hole.
Okay, good. So that's one of the points of contention. Do you think there's a bound on entropy? Can you have can you condense all the information of the universe down to something that is small? And of course, if you don't believe that, and many people don't, then there is really no problem. And then there are different points of view, of course. But then there are more radical people amongst us, like Bob Holden and others, who actually, Emil and Gerard Truft, too. We all have our own idea for maybe physics at the horizon being radically different. So he wants to, I guess, identify things on the two sides of this eternal black hole. So if you fall into the black hole, you're going to come out on the other side, possibly. Although I don't think he was very clear on that. He was telling us at the end that he was warming up to the echoes. So the idea being that things can actually get reflected off the horizon in one way or another, or whatever, or the would-be horizon, I should say. And Bob, in fact, Bob Holden talked about that. And he did tell us about his search for echoes, all finding consistent results. It's hard to quantify, or at least I don't know what the p-value is for these searches, but it's kind of compelling that they all give, for all these independent events, they give consistent values, which translate to, it's a small, that there is a fundamental scale, which is 12 orders of magnitude bigger than proper Planck length, and it seems that there is something sitting there around all of these black holes, possibly. The real question is that, is this real, or is just some, you're just finding noise in the data, and these are all the same, the same instrument that gathers all the data. So maybe you're just finding noise peaks. So the kind of signal are these repeating echoes that you expect if there is some sort of a cavity that's formed between the angular momentum barrier and the firewall or whatever or replaces the horizon. So I think that's something to watch out for. I just want to say, we also have looked for it. There seem to be, we found some evidence for the echoes as well. But again, it's not everybody believes this. So it's a point of controversy, at least in the gravitational wave community. So anybody, any questions, thoughts on this? Bob, do you want to add anything?
What's your definition of a firewall?
Yeah, I think the firewall is the best word, or the most compelling word I found for not quite a black hole, because not quite a black hole is like five words or something. So firewall is the shortest word I found. I think that's my definition of firewall is that if you replace the standard black hole with anything else, which is visible, I guess, just observationally different. It doesn't have to be the firewall people don't define a firewall, they just define what it's not, which is the standard black hole.
So we're all talking about a firewall. We all agree
that. I don't know, but I think that's a matter of definition. The question is, what observational differences are there? And it's actually kind of interesting. So possibly Gerard Tuft and you and myself, we all think there might be possible echoes, and Emil as well. So we're yet to convince Jim that there are echoes, but I guess we'll see. Either it takes more data or more convincing. Yes?
Can you say what your significance was?
This is 4.2 sigma, so the p-value for our thing is 10 to the minus 5. And this was like something, we found this around 1 second after the binary neutron star merger. So that was, and I think for Bob's measurements, at least not this measurement, but the previous published paper, between 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 2.
What you're plotting there is the likelihood as a function of the
this thing?
Yeah,
this thing is kind of the strength of echoes that you find and it's unfortunately this is not visible. This is time, and there is a frequency, there's a three-dimensional. So the time is when the echoes happen, and the frequency at which they happen. And there is a specific frequency and time at which you see this huge, basically 5 sigma peak.
Is it surprising to see it around binary neutron stars?
So the idea would be that the two neutron stars merge, and then they form collapse into a black hole. And then after that happens, you see the echoes, right?
Is this an event? Is this, you also detect how do your two detected frequencies relate?
I think one is twice the other one, unless it's a change.
Yeah.
Yeah, I talk about a whole set of spikes, and this one would be right at the low end of my set.
Mm-hmm.
But
right. So the thing is, since we are looking for integer multiples,
it's what you would call the fundamental frequency of the cavity.
Yeah. Right, so I mean, there are degeneracies like a factor of two, which is because these things are integer multiples, so it's easy to confuse those or say, is it like 70 hertz or 140 hertz? Because one is twice the other. So that's kind of the point that it's not clear which one is correct, but we see basically the same things. Do you agree?
More or less.
More or less, yeah.
So the only comments that we'd make is, the word firewall, I think, is very misleading because mm-hmm. it suggests something very hot. And it need not be hot.
But I mean, this is hot, right?
I mean, at the surface itself.
At the surface. But don't you think it gets hotter if it hits the surface?
Oh, if you are accreting matter and it's heating up.
Yeah.
But in the configuration I represent, it's essentially zero temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, of course, controversial and what's radical depends on your point of view, but I tried to emphasize that this could have been incorporated in standard GR, 100 years ago.
No, absolutely, and I agree. Conservative and radical is very much subjective, it's very subjective.
I think we've also posted the picture blue, red, doesn't have to be yellow and red.
Okay, that's very good. Very good point. Okay, so let's see. Let's try to go through this. Of course, we learned about a lot of other data. So the future of CXP, where X could be M or N, microwave or neutrino. We had talks from Nilima, Moritz, and Chris. So there's CMBS4, there's CMBHD, and possibly CNBHD, if you wait long enough. We can solve interesting outstanding problems, maybe CDM on a small scale, but CMB lensing, we could finally clearly address that. Of course, Neil Dalal, as usual, he objected that he doesn't believe whatever comes out of that analysis, because there could be baryons and stars and such. There is another thing that didn't come up in any talks, but there's also a question of inflationary B modes, and is there a good target for that? I guess there's another target to talk about. So does anybody want to make any comment about this, about the inflationary B modes? Should we go look for them? I don't, Nilima and I had a brief chat, and maybe we'll let them later. So should we go look for B modes?
Sure.
Okay, good. I don't hear any any objections. So yes, let's go ahead and find B modes. The power of cross-correlation that came up, so this stuff that you could do with kinetic asset, you really need galaxies to do. So there is synergy between all the galaxy surveys that are coming up and the CMB. Kinetic asset is a good thing. We heard about it. We can prove things that you wouldn't be able to prove otherwise. And then with the neutrinos, we may possibly solve all these problems if they're ever funded and you can see the neutrino background. Maybe the lithium problem, because you're actually now seeing all the way to the Big Bang nuclear synthesis with the neutrino background. The Hubble tension could be solved because you could see evidence for early dark energy there. And maybe all these anomalies with the baseline experiments that came up could be addressed somehow. So I think the future is bright. Any comments about these neutrinos or CMB? I guess I have. I guess we're getting late. So I'm just going to rush through. The thing with the CDM crisis, and this is a plot from Nilima's talk, is that you do actually have all these other probes of a small scale structure on CDM. And in particular, this is a new paper by Licia Verde and collaborators. You could get future constraints from various tests on very small, very large case, very small scales. But in particular, from a strong lensing, there are constraints that are very strong that come from very small scales. And Actually, so I mean, one thing is that, so the, with these constraints, can we rule out dark matter models? So I wonder whether Latham, does your dark matter model make a prediction on, like, on these small scales?
The way to rule it out most easily is to detect that the lightest neutrino mass is not zero.
Okay, but let's say if it is zero, then...
I think in terms of this, I just think it behaves like just very ultra-cold adiabatic dark matter. So.
But I mean, at some point it would turn off, or would it go, like, go all the way to infinite wave number?
Sorry?
So,
say again, you mean is there a small scale cutoff on the very small on these scales.
This is the power spectrum of CDM as a function of wave number, which I guess CDM probably predicts to be something scale invariant, but they turn off depending on the mass of dark matter particle.
Yeah, I think indeed it does cut off, but it's very small.
But see, the point is that you can actually go to very small scales with, in at least using some probes. So something to consider.
By very small.
This has to do with some primordial black holes. This paper is most about primordial black holes. So alpha is kind of depends on the model of how you form primordial black holes. So it's not very important for this.
By very small, I think it's kilohertz today or something like that.
Okay. I don't know in megaparsecs that means.
Much smaller size there.
Okay. Then. So, yeah.
If there are no primordial black holes,
so about
zero, what happens to all these?
Well, I mean, actually, this uses primordial black holes. The rest of them have nothing to do with primordial black holes, right? So, like, for example, the quasars or pulsar timing or SKA, they're just looking for gravitational effect of substructure on either pulsars or strong lenses. So, and speaking of a strong lensing, we heard excellent talk about lensing in general, and particularly strong lensing. So, a very old paper by Dalal and Kochanek talks about how well you can measure substructure or CDM with a strong lensing.
The paper was in 1913.
I just meant it's an old paper. Okay, so he has started the field of testing CDM with a strong lensing. But of course, now we can do better. there are LIGO events that some of them could be strongly lensed. There could be fast radio bursts that are strongly lensed. We heard that from Bailey. And since they have very different kind of objects, fast radio bursts have very precise timing. LIGO events also have very precise timing, and you could see them to very far away, and they're very, very small. So you can probe much smaller scales that have been probed before, and it's much higher in a very different regime. And I mean, this is the kind of effect that a strong lensing could have on LIGO events. So that's another thing to look forward to. The fast radio bursts, of course, that's another whole field that we're going to learn much more about, millions of them, hopefully. What are they? Are they promising probes of fundamental physics or cosmology? What can you do with a million fast radio bursts? That's something to think about. Of course, I asked Bailey whether there could be aliens that are signaling this to us. He dismissed it, but I still think it's a worth question to think that aliens should be doing something out there. I mean, this could be it. Does anybody want to say something about, I mean, will fast radio bursts live? I mean, because everybody was very positive about them. I didn't hear any criticism. Surprisingly, nothing from Neil. I don't know why he was criticizing.
Criticizing fast radio bursts in existence?
Well, as a cosmological probe.
I oppose these bursts.
It's a systematic error, it won't go away.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe there's any way to criticize them. Well, the question is, will they be precise cosmological probes? I guess one the question is that until you understand what's happening at the source, that could be, there could be systematics that would affect you. But that could be another thing to look forward to, something you can think about after this meeting, if you're interested in cosmological probes of, like, 10 years from now. So 21 centimeters is another thing we're gonna see much more of. So Maxim Pospilov argued that this edges result, which made a lot of noise a year ago or so, might be due to dark photons. And I guess dark photons were invented by Bob Holdham, is that correct?
More or less,
yeah. And I asked him what he thinks about them, and I think, actually, I don't want to misquote you, so what do you think about dark photons now?
I don't think much of them.
Right, so I think that's yeah, so I just, that's, I just, that, I leave you with that. So of course, they are very much constrained, but I mean, if there are anomalies, maybe we will find, they will be revived, and they could explain some anomalies. But right now, apparently, I guess Bob prefers to think about echoes, so that should be, let that be a lesson for particle physicists. But then 21 centimeter, apart from these edges, there will be much more 21 centimeter in the future. You're gonna measure distances to very high redshifts very, very precisely, and I guess we didn't talk too much about it, but another thing to look forward to. So let me see, I'm almost done, and I really don't want to say much. There is a lot about gravitational wave astronomy, which is, sorry, let me just make this a bit bigger. So that's also exciting. Let's see. We heard an excellent talk about Gaia. I think we're gonna understand Milky Way much, much better. But I'm not sure whether we're gonna learn more about galaxy formation or dark matter. Again, particle physicists are working on this, so I guess the hope is to learn about dark matter. And we have amazing progress in galaxy formation simulation, so I guess it's hard to say which one of these is real or not, although actually here we know this is from a simulation, this is the real Gaia data. So, but the point is that they have very similar features if the color scales are correct. Ultimately, the question is, can we basically use these simulations to learn more about the nature of dark matter than galaxy formation? But I imagine Neil would be skeptical of that. Okay, so I just wanted to leave you with a couple of theory. I mean, of course, we heard lots of great ideas about observations, but we also heard lots of great theoretical ideas. So one of them that was kind of recurring was a CPT symmetry, both for Big Bang and black holes. So we heard that black holes could have CPT symmetry at their at this point, basically, at the origin of the causal diagram from Tuft. And we heard from Latham that the universe could have CPT symmetry at the point of Big Bang. So that's actually a very interesting and powerful idea, especially given that CPT symmetry is an exact symmetry of Lorentz invariance theories. The question is, can we come up with predictions? And Tuft thinks that maybe he could get echoes, so then I like that. From Latham and Neil Turok's idea, the question is, will there be predictions that could be tested? Maybe something about dark matter. I mean, he mentioned the mass of neutrinos. That would be exciting. I think what I'm looking forward to is when you can predict the scalar perturbations from Big Bang, because that's, of course, what we do measure very precisely. So hopefully that's coming up very soon.
Yeah, we're working on it.
And I guess the question is, do we really need inflation to make sense of this? And I think you hope that you don't need inflation. Okay, good. So any comments? Questions? Okay, so, and I guess this is my last slide. Of course, there were interesting theory ideas, and I think questions I'm gonna leave you with here are, is microcausality necessary? I think particle physicists usually assume that as a religion, but I think we heard from Damiano. Are you here still? There you are, yeah, that it may not be. So the question is, what does predictivity mean in a quantum theory? I mean, his theory violates microcausality, but is it still a predictive theory in a sense that I guess we like as physicists? So is microcausality the same as causality? I think that's an excellent question to think about. And I think just dismissing theories because they violate some arbitrary principle is not necessarily a very healthy practice. So I think this is a great question to ask. Does anybody have any comments about this microcausality? Bob, yeah?
Well, I completely agree.
Completely agree.
Yeah, why not think about it?
Yeah, exactly. And especially since the only renormalizable theory of gravity that we know is the stellar gravity, the RS squared gravity with is the square of y, etc., then it's probably worthwhile to think about it. If I mean, the only price that we pay is quantum microcausality. If it's okay, really, maybe we should think more seriously. And the other part is that also Stravinsky inflation is the same theory. So RS squared is a renormalizable theory of gravity. And is a successful theory of early universe, which is consistent with all the data, and it only has basically a couple of three parameters as we heard. So what does it mean for black holes? I mean, something to think about. Is there a Hamiltonian for Fakons? So, Damiana, do you have a position on that? Is there a Hamiltonian?
It's something that should be looked into.
Okay, good. So I'm going to bring it up again so that there is more reason to look into it.
Until May next year.
May next year, yeah. You have until May next year. Good. Okay, so the last two things are, I think there were excellent talks by Francesco and Brandon. So Brandon talked about the positivity constraints. And I think my question for him is that do we care about locality of gravity, given that, I mean, we don't know whether quantum gravity is local for a fact. Now, some theories are. And do we care about the scattering amplitudes in a theory in Minkowski space, even though we don't care, we don't live in Minkowski space? So that's, of course, I mean, I think he had this powerful mathematical machinery that was based on this assumption of basically scattering being well defined in Minkowski space. But since we don't live in Minkowski space, should be careful.
I mean, you live in Minkowski space, but you can imagine to vary the matter count from your theory, and the theory still makes sense.
But I mean, the makes sense is.
The matter count of your theory, you won't be in Minkowski. But you change the equations if you change the matter count, no, you keep the same equations.
But if you're not in, if less than Minkowski space is not available, we don't.
It's a solution of the theory.
Okay, so it's a Minkowski is a pathological solution of the theory. So you just that just says Minkowski space is not correct. Doesn't mean the theory is incorrect. Okay. I don't. So that's something to think about. I know again that's not necessarily very mainstream, but we don't live in Minkowski space, and even in general relativity there are pathological solutions that we don't dismiss. Like, for example,
so which space do we live?
Well, I mean, observationally, it seems that we're the sitter space.
You put the Earth, the Moon,
for example,
or you remove that constant.
Well, no, I'm just talking about the asymptotic boundary constant, like the cosmological constant, right? So we live in the sitter, at least at late times. So that would be the thing that. And especially even thinking about infrared behavior, like very, very low mass graviton, if the mass is comparable to the cosmological constant, then it's not clear to me that this scattering amplitude is a correct thing to talk about, because we don't have a scattering on the sitter scale. So anyway, something to think about. And finally, I guess maybe the most embarrassing problem in the history of physics is the cosmological constant problem. The question I have for Francesco, are you somewhere? Right? There you are. So the question is adding an extra dimension plus brains worth it, really? So.
I mean, it is one parameter.
Which is very much fine-tuned.
Yeah, it's true, but you can think, I mean, the beauty of holography, you can think about it the same, about the same theory as being just purely four-dimensional, just from.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't like extra, you have to add extra states, sure.
Yeah.
A bunch of extra stuff, but it could be just a four-dimensional strongly coupled freedom, theory with a long degrees of freedom.
Right.
Now, yeah, you still have to add stuff. I don't know.
Right. I guess the question is how many free parameters are we inventing, or free functions? Yeah.
Yes. Mm.
So, but I think it's given the long history of this problem, it's certainly I would think it would be amazing if we find a solution. And when we do, then we can decide whether it's worth it or not, or if there are testable predictions. So that's it. So thank you all. I just wanted to end by thanking all the other people who you don't, I guess, were not officially in the organizing committee, but did most of the organizing, most especially Stephanie Moll, who was the conference, who is the conference program lead. She's on vacation now, but you all have received emails from her. All the people from audiovisual, especially Margaret and Josh, who basically recorded all of these and set all of us up, especially with all the conferencing business with England, and actually live streaming at this at the colloquium. So thank you all. Let's thank all of them. One of them is probably listening to us right now. I'm not sure who it is, but maybe. Yeah. Are you Josh? Is Josh, are you there?
Yes,
please. Okay, there you go. Thank you very much. Okay, wonderful. So yeah, always someone listening to us. You should remember this. and thank you all, and have a safe trip back. Thanks.